Hello, my name is Dan Ravisher. I'm Executive Director of the Public Patent Foundation, a not-for-profit legal services organization based in New York that represents the public's interests in the patent system, and particularly the public's interest against wrongly issued patents and unsound patent policy. Over the course of the next hour or so, I'm going to give you an introduction to how to find prior art for an issued patent. First, we're going to define what it is we're looking for, a step that I call identifying the target. Then we're going to define what actually constitutes prior art. As we'll talk about later, there are actually a number of things that can qualify as being prior art, and there are also a number of ways that those things can qualify as being prior art. Last, I'll suggest ways one can go about finding prior art for an issued patent, should they want to. You should have in front of you both the slides and the model patent, which were included together as one file in the materials distributed for this course. The patent was behind the slides. If possible, it'd be best if you have this set of slides and the patent separate from one another so that you don't need to flip around as I talk and take you through the slides and refer to the patent as an example. So let's first familiarize ourselves with a patent. For some of you who may already be familiar with patents, this will be a little bit introductory. But for those of you who are not, I find this is a worthwhile exercise just to get some familiarization underway. If you look at the cover of the model patent, at the top left-hand corner, you'll see that it is titled United States Patent. Underneath the title, you'll see the name of the inventive entity for the patent. The inventive entity name is the last name of the first identified inventor, and if there is more than one identified inventor, the Latin phrase et al. Is added. They don't list more than one name for the inventive entity name at the top of the patent. So, for example, you can see here the inventive entity is Dranch et al., and that's because the first inventor's last name is Dranch, and this is a Miss Dranch, is not the only inventor. If Miss Dranch was the only inventor, the inventive entity name would be just Dranch. Staying above the horizontal line on the top right-hand side of the patent, you'll see the patent number, and underneath that, the patent's date of issuance. Patents are numbered sequentially as they issue. And as you can see, this patent is a little over a year old, and it's in the mid-6 millions. I believe we're only in the high 6 millions today, but we'll be in the 7 millions shortly. As we'll talk about a little bit more later, when it comes to finding prior art, and let me emphasize that this statement pertains only to the issue of finding prior art, the issue date of the target patent is completely irrelevant. So the fact that this patent was issued on July 15th, 2003, absolutely of no consequence when it comes to finding prior art for this patent. Now, for other issues in patent law, and particularly damages, the issue date of the target patent is very important, very relevant. But for prior art purposes, which is what we're talking about here today, you can just forget it. Now, below the horizontal line on the cover of the patent, you'll see various types of information presented in a two-column format, and there's a single drawing at the bottom. Some of this information is relevant for finding prior art, and some of it is not. When we get to the point of the conversation where some of this information is relevant, we'll refer back to the cover. Now, if you flip past the cover, which for this patent is actually 2 pages. You'll see the next part of the patent, which is the drawings. Now, this patent only has 1 drawing, which is a bit lower than average, but that may be due to the fact that this technology is not highly technical and is not highly capable of being drawn. I mean, we're just talking about dough for baked goods. Behind the drawings, or the drawing in this case, is a section of the patent called the specification, or shorthand called the spec. These are pages of text arranged in 2-column format. You'll see that this patent has 7 pages of spec with a total of 14 columns. Now, in patent parlance, the page of the patent is never used for reference. No one ever says, look on page 4 of the patent. Rather, whenever you're referring to a specific part of a patent, you always refer to the column and line numbers. As you flip through the specification just briefly, you'll see the various sections, or what are traditionally the various sections of a specification. You'll see a background which talks about the state of the art prior to this invention, and particularly what problems were not being solved, or what solutions had not been realized as of yet. Then you'll get into a brief summary of the invention, a description of the drawings, which basically just gives you which just identifies what they are, and then you get into a detailed description of the invention, which has to disclose a preferred embodiment of the invention, and which also uses the drawings to assist in disclosing what it is that the inventor claims to have invented. At the very end of the specification, beginning in column 12, line 62, you will see what is called the section known as the claims. And this is indicated by the beginning of a sentence that reads, "What is claimed is." The claims of the patent are single sentence paragraphs that define the scope of the patent, and patents can have numerous claims. Technically, neither the title, the abstract, the drawings, nor any other part of the specification define what specifically the patent covers. Rather, it's only the claims themselves that define what is covered by the patent. So, for instance, if one was to look at the title of this patent, flipping back to the cover, if they didn't know that it's the claims that define a patent and not other parts of the patent, they might look at the title of this patent and be like, you know, this patent says it covers dough for making baked goods. Well, that can't be valid. People have been using dough to make baked goods forever. But that person would be manifesting a lack of understanding that it is what is stated in the claims of the patent and not anywhere else that defines what is covered by the patent. Now, having said that, the parts of a patent other than the claims are relevant to and can impact the scope of a patent. Or in other words, they can impact the interpretation of the claims or the definition of the claims. But they themselves do not, by definition, define the scope of the patent. Now, typically the claims are the end of the patent, but in this case you'll see that the last page is actually a certificate of correction. These aren't very frequent, but they also aren't, high anomalies. Basically, once a patent is issued, it can't be changed. So if there's a typo in it, the patent office issues one of these certificates of correction to indicate a fixing of that typo. It's kind of like the Constitution doesn't get edited, but rather it gets amended. It's the same principle. So let's look at one of the model claims, or one of the claims of the model patent, claim number 1. And for this, if you look at the slides, you'll see that on one slide is the claim in the same layout that it exists in the patent, just in paragraph form, one just long sentence. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see that the same claim has been structured in a way that makes it a little bit more discernible and a little bit more compartmentalized. This is something that I do and something that many patent attorneys do when they're dissecting, analyzing, and even writing claims, is to break them down into component parts. And then when they're in the patent themselves, many patent attorneys just combine it all as one long sentence. But when it comes to analyzing the claim, which is the first step you need to do in finding prior art for a patent, it's helpful sometimes to structure it the way that it has been done in the slides. Now, as you look at the claim, you'll see the beginning says an edible dough product comprising, and the word comprising is underlined because that is what's known as a transitional phrase. Everything before the transitional phrase is the preamble, and most often is not relevant to the scope of the claim, although sometimes it is. Everything after the transition phrase is what's called the body of the claim, and those are the elements of the claim. And the transition phrase indicates to you whether the claim is open or closed. And what's meant by that is if a transition is open, that means that this claim covers anything that includes these elements, regardless of it if it also includes something else. If the transition phrase was closed, that would mean the claim would only cover something that includes the elements described in the body and nothing else. So, for instance, if a claim said a widget comprising a flat surface and four legs connected thereto so that a human being could place objects on top of the widget. This is a table. If the transition phrase was comprising, which is a buzzword in patent parlance for open claim language, that would mean that claim would cover anything which had a flat surface and four legs. So if there was something that was a flat surface and five legs or six legs or a flat surface, four legs and a vase or four legs and a lamp, those would all be covered by the claim. If instead the claim had closed language consisting of, that would mean the claim would be limited only to things that had a flat surface and four legs and nothing else. So a table which had a flat surface four and five legs would not be covered by that claim. As you read through the claim, you'll see italicized a few words, edible particles, and then down at the end, the initials SFI. Those are words that do not, to my knowledge, have a specific, concrete, unarguable definition. Those are words that I would believe are subject to perhaps various different meanings. Or in the case of SFI, I have no idea what that word means. So if someone's to say, what does this patent cover? And we got to the part saying SFI, someone would say to you, well, what's SFI? And I would say, you know, I don't know what that means. So when it comes to defining either arguable terms or terms which you have no knowledge of, that's where you look to other parts of the patent. So if you turn to the next page, you'll see that the specification of the patent, the other parts of the specification, help us to define these terms that are in the patent claim. So, for instance, in column 5, lines 28 through 29, you'll see that SFI stands for solid fat index, and that helps explain it to us. The point here is to understand what is meant by the claims, what they cover, what they define, because once you know the scope of the claim, that's the target of prior art that you're searching for. You must find prior art that invalidates the entire claim, and we'll talk about how different types of prior art invalidate claims in different ways in just a moment. But what if, even after reading the patent claim and the specification, there's still a little bit of ambiguity or uncertainty about what a term means? There are other places you can go to look for help in defining what the patent claim terms mean. The first place to go is what's called the file history or the file wrapper or the prosecution history of the patent. This is the file of correspondence which occurred between the patent office and the patent applicant with respect to this patent. And in fact, you have to read the file history before you can truly be certain that you have a correct conclusion about the scope of patent claims. And that's because during the course of the file history, the applicant or the office can make statements which would define claims in ways that one could not predict or foresee by looking only at the patent claim language or at the patent specification. For instance, with our example, the applicant in the file history may have made a statement that the term edible in the claim language of this patent means something that is small enough for a baby of 6 weeks old to chew and swallow safely. Now, most of us would probably not think that that is the definition of edible when we just see the word edible. We think edible is something that a human being could eat and maybe a baby can't, but you know, lots of foods are edible even though babies can't eat them. Well, if in the file history an applicant makes a statement like that, that will be used to interpret the word in the claim. And if you didn't know that statement because you hadn't reviewed the file history, you'd come to inaccurate conclusions about whether or not you found prior art. Staying on that example, we'll come back to it later when we're talking about the different types of prior art. So the file history is something that must be reviewed. It's kind of like you have to read the entire patent, you have to review the entire file history. And these are available. You can get the copy of the file history from the patent office themselves. They tend to be a little bit slower than some commercial services that you can use, which have websites that you can find pretty easily. And you pay them like $1 a page or $1.25 a page. And they will go to the patent office and pull the file history themselves and photocopy it for you and send it to you either in hard form or in PDF form or what have you. So once you've read through the patent, dissected the claims, read through the specification for any definition it gives to the claim terms, you've gone through the file history. If there's still some uncertainty or ambiguity, you can sometimes, although it's not as favored as these other sources of defining the claims, you can go to what's called extrinsic evidence. And this is sources of definition of claims terms that exist outside of the patent and the applicant. So these are things like dictionaries, other patents, other publications, other things that would be prior art, what experts in the field might say. You know, an expert in this field might define edible as being something completely different, or they may believe it's not accurately defined by whatever common understanding you may have of it. But like I said, when defining claims, what is identified as intrinsic evidence, which is the claim language itself, the specification itself, the file history, that's always the preferred sources of information regarding what the words in the claims mean. Now we know what the scope of a patent is. We know that the scope of this claim one is an edible dough free from particles comprising a fat, wherein the fat has a solid fat index falling within one of the ranges given. That's the scope of the claim. That's the target. That's what we have to find. We have to find prior art that would invalidate an edible dough free from particles with a fat selected from the group listed there, wherein the fat has a solid fat index within one or more of the following ranges. So you see how that is very, very different from what one would think the patent covers simply by reading the title of the patent. If you went out and found some dough for baked goods, but it had a whole bunch of particles in it, one might think that's prior art that invalidates this patent. And as we look at the claim, we see that the edible dough has to be free from particles. So prior art that has particles may not, very well may not invalidate this claim. So now we've defined the target. We've defined the scope of the claims. And each claim, when it comes to prior art and validity, lives or dies on its own. If there are, in this patent, 25 claims, if you invalidate claim one, that does you no conclusive good towards claims 2 through 25. It may help with claims 2 through 25, but simply invalidating claim 1 does not mean claims 2, 3, 4, and etc. are invalid as well. You have to invalidate each claim on its own. Now, enforceability is a different issue under patent law, which generally the entire patent and all of its claims rise or fall together. But those are more equitable issues or issues based on conduct of the patentee and not substantive issues like prior art. Just so you know, infringement is also a claim-by-claim analysis. So simply because somebody infringes claim one does not mean they would necessarily infringe some other claim in the patent, although there's a nuance there about dependent claims. The point being, when you do a prior art search, you're searching for prior art that invalidates every claim within the patent, not just one. If you just invalidate one, there's still the other patents that you have to deal with. So moving on to the various types of prior art. And if you look at the slide, I've listed them out. There are basically five types of prior art, preeminent types of prior art. The first is prior invention. The second is something that was accessible to the public for a year. And the third is prior application. And those may sound very similar, and they are. There's a lot of overlap. They're all in the same section of the code, and we'll talk about how they're similar and how they're different in a minute. Then there's obviousness, and this is the one pretty much everyone's heard of. You know, that patent's invalid because it was obvious. We'll talk about that in a minute, what that really means. And then there's double patenting, and there are two types of double patenting. There's Section 101 double patenting, and there's obviousness type double patenting. So 102 prior art, and this is 35 U.S.C. Section 102. 35 is the title of the United States Code that deals with patents. And you'll see there are actually A through G is listed types of things that prevent someone from deserving a patent. Some of them deal with prior art, some of them don't. We're going to talk about the most important ones. So 102A, the statute says that if before the target's invention date, and we're going to talk in a minute what it means to be the invention date. Remember I said the issue date of a patent is absolutely irrelevant, but the invention date is important. If a reference, and we'll use the term reference to distinguish something from being prior art. Prior art is a legal conclusion that a reference is prior art. It's kind of like if you said, he assaulted me, as opposed to he hit me. He hit me is kind of a factual thing. You know, he hit me. Well, assault is a legal conclusion that he committed some crime. In the same way, a reference is a factual statement that there is some document that exists or some thing that exists. That's kind of inarguable. What people argue about is whether or not the reference qualifies as prior art. If it doesn't qualify as prior art, it can't be used to invalidate a claim. If it does, then it can. So if there is a reference that you can find which indicates that the invention or what's defined in the scope of the claims was known or used by others in this country, and note that means the United States, or if you can find a reference that is a patent or a printed publication anywhere in the world prior to the target's invention date, that's 102A prior art. So first we need to know what is the target's invention date, so we know what we have to find existed before that date. You don't know what somebody's invention date is 99% of the time. That's because it's confidential and people don't disclose when they actually invented something. But what patent law does is it uses a crutch. It uses a crutch of the effective filing date of the patent, because patent law considers the filing of a patent constructive invention or constructive reduction to practice, they say. So once someone has filed a patent application, you know they invented it at least on that date or before. I mean, you're pretty certain it's before because it would take them time to write up the application. But patent law presumes that absent any other evidence, you presume that the invention date of a patent is its effective application date. So let's look at the cover of our model patent. If you look in the first column about a third of the way down, you'll see that this patent was filed on August 20th, 2002. Now that was the filing of this patent, and that was that is the application date of this patent. But it may not be the effective application date. And what that means is, in the United States and most other countries, you can file a patent application and claim priority to another application so long as some requirements of similarity are met. If you look down a couple lines below the August 20, 2002 date, you'll see a related U.S. application data. That's where some effective filing date information will be identified. And you'll see here that they say this application is a continuation of another application that was filed on August 15th, 2000, which has now been issued into a patent. And if you flip to the first page of the specification, you'll see cross-reference in column one, cross-reference to related application. Basically, it says the same thing. Now, when someone files a continuation under the law, this isn't very intuitive, but under the law, they get the benefit of that filing date. So although the application date of this patent per se is August 20th, 2002, the effective application date is August 15th, 2000 because they filed a continuation. What kind of related applications are possible? There are continuations like we have here. There are divisionals. There are continuations in part. If it's a continuation or a divisional, there's usually no argument about whether or not they actually do deserve that effective filing date, because those types of applications don't add anything new. They cut and paste either the entire same thing as the prior application or some subset of that prior application. And I would venture to guess, even though I haven't done it, if you went and looked at patent 6551640, it may very well be exactly the same in all respects, except the cover and the claims. A continuation in part, however, means that the application, which is a continuation in part of another, only is partially derived from its parent. And it's partially derived from some other source, either another application or it's new matter. So it would be unclear in that patent whether or not the subject matter claimed came from the original application. If so, then it deserves that application's filing date, or if it was new matter added in at the time of filing of that precise application. If that would be the case, then it would only deserve that in application date. But here it's simple. This patent is a continuation of one that was filed August 15th, 2000. We take that as the de facto invention date for this patent. Now, if you look at the slides I've indicated here, there's inherent uncertainty and susceptibility here. What that means is, we'll talk about it later, but let's say you had a reference that you cited as a 102A prior art reference. And it was a printed publication in Japan that was published on August 1st, 2000. Under 102A, that would satisfy the requirements because it's prior to the target's invention date of August 15th, 2000. It's described in a printed publication in a foreign country, so you're good to go. The problem is that the patent owner can come in and say, well, although our application date is August 15th and we realize that is the presumed invention date, we actually have proof that we invented it in January of 2000. And such proof would be like lab books and other kind of documentation. And if they were successful in doing that, they could say, see, we actually invented this in January of 2000. That would eliminate the possibility of your Japanese publication from being 102A prior art, because now we know that the invention date was at least January 2000, and it may still very well have been before that. We're not absolutely sure that the inventor has the patent owner has disclosed to us all information they have about when they invented this. But for the purposes of this Japanese article, they've at least come in with enough evidence to prove that they invented it before the publication date of that article. So that's why I refer to 102A art as being susceptible to an undermining by evidence that the patent owner may have. So if you have 102A prior art, that's good, but it's not a slam dunk. It's something that may have the rug pulled out from under it due to the inventor's actual prior invention. So now let's talk about a different kind of prior art, a very, very strong kind of prior art, a kind of prior art that cannot be undermined by such evidence, and that's 102B art. 102B art, the reason why it's not susceptible to the same problems as 102A is because it is not targeted off the invention date. It is actually targeted off the application date. And there's nothing the owner of the patent can do to change the application date. The application date is what it is. It's on the patent. It can't be changed. They can't come in with evidence that they applied for it before what the patent says they did. The application date is what it is. The downside of 102B is it has to be a reference that existed more than a year before that application date. So whereas 102A only had to be prior to the invention date, there's no one-year grace period or one-year time zone buffer. 102B says, okay, we're going to target off application date, which is dead set, certain, but it has to be a reference that existed for more than a year. And here you'll see the categories of prior art are very similar to those listed under 102A. And the first type of 102B art is exactly like the second type of 102A prior art, which is a patent or a publication in anywhere in the world. Now, the second type of 102B art is something that was in public use or on sale in the United States. And that's similar because 102A, if you compare, you'll see it's known or used by others, and this is in public use or on sale. So public use and used by others is about the same. But 102B is limited just to things that are on sale, whereas 102A is broader and says anything that was known. And there is a whole bunch of case law about what it means to be on sale. But for what we're talking about, finding prior art, it's very atypical to find 102B prior art that's actually something that was on sale. Even when you do find it, most of the time it's the inventor's own thing. So if you go to, let's look at the cover of the patent, and you look and you see that this is assigned to General Mills in the first column at the top. You know, maybe General Mills was selling dough that meets all the limitations of these claims more than a year before. And again, the application date for 102B purposes is the effective application date of the patent. So that would be August 15, 2000. So if we have evidence that General Mills sold some of this dough on August 1st, 1999, that would be 102B prior art under the on sale in this country provision. The third type of 102 prior art that is of the three categories that is most easy to find or to work with is what's called 102E prior art. Now we're back to the same problems as 102A because 102E is targeted off the invention date. So again, we're relying on the effective application date of the patent, but we realize that this type of prior art is susceptible to being declassified as prior art if the applicant can come in with evidence that they invented it before whatever dates are keyed here. Now, this is a little bit confusing, but 102E's purpose is to say if two people are running to the patent office with applications for the same invention, they don't know each other, it's just coincidence. If one of them beats the other one by a day or by any amount of time, But that second one files before the first one actually gets a patent. It would be impossible for the second one to have known of that first patent. And another way of saying this, that patent that issues to the first one, the one who wins the race, could not be 102A prior art, because the second person filed their patent application before the patent issued. So 102E implements the theory that only one person, the first inventor, gets a patent. And if we have this rapidly developing technology, like software, like business methods, or you know anything else you can think of that's rapidly evolving, where there's lots of people inventing very quickly, and the patent office can't issue patents fast enough to keep up with it, this is a section where you'll find a lot of prior art. So what it says is, a patent has been granted that was applied for before the invention date of the target. So, and this has to be by another, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's turn to the next slide, and you'll see the comparison between 102 prior art. I want to just go through that real quick. And I'm not using the Dranch patent as an example here. I put my own dates there just to drive home a couple points. So let's say your target patent has an effective application date of June 1st, 2000. And the issue date, like I've told you before, absolutely irrelevant. Absolutely irrelevant for these purposes. The first reference you come across has an application date of July 1st, 1997, and it issued, it was a patent. It applied for in July 1st, 1997, and it issued in June 2nd, 1998. That would be prior art under 102A because it was prior to the invention date, which we're presuming is 6/1/2000, because it is the reference one issued in 6/2/98. It's prior art under 102B because it was patented more than a year before the application date of the target, because this is June 2nd, 98, that's more than a year before June 1st, 2000. And it's prior art under 102E, because it was a patent that granted from an application, the application having been filed prior to the invention date of the target. So reference one, which is a patent, is prior art under all three sections. Now, if you were ever to identify it, you wouldn't say, well, this is prior art under 102A, 102B, and 102E. You just say this is 102B art, because B is the strongest kind of art. It's unarguable. It can't be undermined. And you just go with the best classification possible. Now, let's say you have another reference, which is another patent, reference number two. It has an application date of July 1st, 97, same application date, but it issued a year later than reference one. It issued June 2nd, 1999. Now, this reference is prior art under 102A. Why? Because it issued before what we believe is the invention date of the target. It is not prior art under 102B because it did not issue more than a year before the application date of the target. By one day, less than a year, it does not qualify as 102B because it issued June 2nd, 99, which is less than a year before June 1st, 2000. So this reference number two is not 102B art. But it is 102E art because it's a patent which issued from an application which was filed before the invention date of the target. July 1st, 1997 being the application date of reference two, which is before June 1st, 2000, which is what we presume to be the invention date of the target. And just to finish the comparison, let's go to reference number three, which is also a patent applied for the same day as the other two references, July 1st, 1997. It issued June 2nd, 2000. Now, one of the reasons I did this with the same application date is to drive home the point that although the issue date of the target patent is irrelevant, the issue dates of reference patents is highly relevant. So going back, reference three, a patent applied for July 1st, 97. It issued June 2nd, 2000. Now, this cannot be 102A prior art because it was not patented before what we know was the invention date, or what we know was at least the latest invention date of the target, the application date of the target being June 1st, 2000. We know they invented it either on June 1st, 2000 or some day before that. Since this reference 3 did not issue until June 2nd, 2000, it wasn't patented before the invention date of the target, therefore it can't be 102A. It's not 102B for the same reasons it's not, reference 2 wasn't 102B because it didn't issue more than a year before the application date. In fact, it issued after the application date. But although this patent is not A or B art, it is E art. And that's because it is a patent that issued, doesn't matter if it issued before or after the target's application date, it just has to be a patent that issued at some date. It's a patent that issued, which was applied for before the invention date of the target. And this reference 3 was applied for July 1st, 97. That was applied for before what we know, or what we are taking as the invention date of the target, which is June 1st, 2000. So let's just go back one slide to 102. There's another issue I want to point out real quick. 102E art, and I have there on the slide, determining what is meant by another. 102E art, let's say you found a reference that you believe qualified under 102E for the model patent that we've been using, the Dranch et al. And it had as its inventor Cynthia Dranch alone. That is a different inventive entity, a different inventor class than the target patent, because the inventor class of the target patent is Dranch and Kreisman, Miss Dranch and Miss Kreisman. A 102E art would be, with just Dranch, would be by another, even though it's the same inventor. On there is an overlap of inventors between them. In the same way, if you had a potential 102E reference, which was Dranch, Kreisman, and John Smith, that would be considered by another than this patent, because the addition of John Smith makes it a different inventive entity. Even though that patent would also be identified as Dranch et al., that's not the relevant inquiry for the determination of by another. Okay, so that's 102 art. Now, once you've found a reference that you think applies to a claim, you've confirmed that it can be classified as prior art under some section of 102, you have to go back to the claims, and you have to find in the reference every single element of the claims. If you go back to the slide which has the claim broken down, if you find a reference that has an edible dough free from particles, which has a fat selected from the group listed there, which has the solid fat index within the ranges listed there, that would be 102 art. But let's say you found a reference which had everything except it was not free from particles. It had particles in it. You couldn't use it as pure 102 art. You'd have to say, well, there is a difference between the claim and the prior art, which I want to use to invalidate the claim. And that difference to me just doesn't seem like they deserved a patent. That's what 103 addresses. That's what 103 obviousness addresses. So let's just read through 103 as I have it here on the slide. A patent may not be obtained, though the invention is not identically disclosed or described as set forth in section 102. So to repeat, if you find a reference that qualifies as 102 prior art and it discloses or describes everything in the claim, you don't need to worry about obviousness. You've got a 102-based argument. But if there's some difference, you can't use 102. You have to use 103. And what 103 says, if the differences between the subject matter sought to be patented or in the patent, the target patent, if the differences between the subject matter in the target patent and the prior art are such that the subject matter as a whole would have been obvious at the time the invention was made, to a person having ordinary skill in the art to which the subject matter pertains, then the patent claim is invalid. Now, I've added in there in the third little paragraph under 103 obvious, the Roman numerals 1 and 2. You won't see that in the language of the statute, but I did that to identify there are a couple elements there. So first, the comparison is as a whole, not the element by element. So you couldn't say, would it be obvious to use dough with without particles when you knew there was dough with particles? You know, would that just be obvious? You have to say the subject matter as a whole in the claim, which is edible dough, which has a fat. Because there may be some types of dough, I don't know if there's unedible dough or some dough that doesn't have fat in it, that it would be obvious to remove the particles. But at the time that Dranch et al. Applied for the patent, there may have been some belief in the art that if you have fat in dough, you have to have particles. And you couldn't remove particles. It wouldn't work because fat needs particles. That's the point of focusing on the subject matter as a whole. You can't break down the element and say, oh, well, it would be obvious to just switch out this element for that element. You have to say, would what is patented have been obvious as a whole, as a combined, as a total claim? Everything described there, would that have been obvious in light of what the reference discloses? That's the inquiry. The at the time the invention was made is important to note, but you get that under 102 anyways, because all the 102 art is something that was known prior to the invention by the applicant. So it'd be impossible. If you have 102 art, they can't come in and say, well, that doesn't evidence anything that was known at the time I made my invention, because all the 102 art existed at the time the applicant made the invention or purported invention. And this defining what is a person having ordinary skill in the art is a big argument, and it's somewhat ambiguous, and people disagree on it when they're in litigation, depending upon what kind of outcome they want. But the point here is you have some 102 prior art references, you have a 102 prior art reference, and it doesn't disclose everything that's in the claim. You then have to go to 103 and argue that the difference between the subject matter in the claim and that prior art reference would have been obvious, and that's some kind of argument you have to make, and you can support it with evidence, you know, declarations, testimony. If you can find other people, other references, this is where people combine references. Let's say you have one reference, going back to the model claim, that discloses everything in claim one except free from particles. Then you have another reference, another 102 references, that discloses everything in claim one except that it's the solid fat indexes are a little of that reference are a little bit outside the ranges. So you've got one reference that teaches everything except free from particles, and you've got another reference which teaches free from particles, but it doesn't teach the solid fat index within the range. You would then argue that it would have been obvious to combine those two teachings. And you have to argue that would be obvious because one of ordinary skill in the art would be familiar with them or would be motivated to combine them. It's a whole nother hour-long discussion we can have, but the basic point is obviousness is the argument you have to make when you don't have a single reference under 102 that's prior art that discloses everything. Now, what does it mean to be identically disclosed? And here's a difference between what's known as obviousness and what's known as inherency. Let's say, we're going to use a different example, let's say you have a patent on walking down the street when the sun is up, and you have a 102 reference which is walking down the street on Monday. Now, that reference doesn't disclose whether or not the sun is up or not. But we know that on Mondays, the sun comes up. That's just an inherent feature of Mondays. You don't have to say that the sun comes up on Monday. That's an inherent part of that prior art reference. The prior art reference doesn't have to say, walking down the street on Monday, and oh, by the way, the sun comes up, and you know there's flowers growing and things like that. That would be inherent. But if the reference you have says walking down the street on Monday night, then you couldn't argue that the sun is up is an inherent part of that reference, because Monday night the sun would not be up. So there you'd have to argue obvious. You'd say, well, walking down the street at night, it would be obvious to walk down the street during the day, because whether or not the sun is up or it's dark out doesn't make a difference to your ability to walk down the street, something like that. So that's obviousness. Now, there's one little quirk here, which is that if you have a 102E reference that basically is owned or assigned to the same person as the target patent, you can't use it under 103. You can use it under 102E, but you can't use it under 103. So before, we were talking about what if there was a reference that was just Dranch. You could use that under 102E, but if it didn't teach something, if there is a difference between it and this Dranch et al. Patent, you couldn't use it for obviousness, because we can assume that that other patent, which would be just a Cynthia Dranch, would have also been assigned to General Mills. So that's a little bit, that's another thing that makes 102E art a little bit weaker, because sometimes a lot of the art you'll find will be from the same inventive corporation or the same body. If you're trying to invalidate an IBM patent on microprocessors or on, you know, hard drives or whatever, you're likely going to find a lot of references that are also owned by IBM. And if they only qualify under 102E, you couldn't use them for an obviousness inquiry. Now, if the reference would qualify as 102A as well as 102E, then you don't classify it as 102E, you just classify it as 102A, and you don't have to worry about this exception to obviousness. The last type of invalidation is double patenting, and this is where you don't qualify for 102, when you don't qualify for the other bases of prior art which require that the reference be by a different inventor. Double patenting is the type of invalidating prior art which is by the same inventor. And basically the point here is you're not allowed under the law, supposedly, to get more than one patent per invention. So the point being, if we went to, let's go to our example on the cover page, we see that this patent is a continuation of another application which issued into another patent. So there's a patent 6551640 out there. If we went and looked at 6551640 and we found a claim which was exactly the same as claim one in this patent, that would violate the law of double patenting, because they will have gotten two patents for the same thing. You find this a lot in like pharmaceutical cases. Pharmaceutical companies will get a lot of patents around the same kind of pharmaceutical. Some will be the composition of matter, some will be some formulation, some will be with some delivery, some will be reduced formulation or pill size, what have you. And people argue, well, they had a patent on the chemical entity, and this is the same invention, so that's double patenting. And that's where a lot of the double patenting cases come from. Section 101 is limited to only the same exact invention. So what if there's a difference? Kind of like the difference between 102 and 103 is 102 is exactly the same. 103 is when there's a difference. You have to argue that's obvious. We have 101, which is limited to only exactly the same thing. If there's a difference between a prior patent to the same inventor and the patent you're trying to invalidate, the courts created, not Congress, but the courts created an obviousness type double patenting, which basically is the same comparison, the same invention type double patenting as obviousness is in 102, where you argue the differences between the prior claims that this person received and the new claims that they received, although there is some difference, that difference would have been obvious. And there's a lot of case law and spilled ink about that. So finally, for the coup de grace of the talk, how do you go about finding some references? there are some good free resources out there, and there are some good for-fee resources. I have listed in here the web addresses of the sources. An excellent for-fee resource, which a lot of people wouldn't classify here, and I didn't put it on the slides, is technical experts or people who have technical know-how. I mean, a lot of people in litigation, a lot of patent attorneys will hire or retain people who know the industry from which the patent comes. And instead of interfacing with the patent office's database through the internet, you interface with the human being's database of knowledge by asking them questions or sending them emails saying, can you help me find some references? These are the dates we have to find the reference existing before. It either has to be a patent or a publication anywhere in the world, or it has to be something that was known in this country, depending upon the various subcategories of 102 you're trying to use, and use the human resources. But these here listed are good as well. The USPTO has a pretty good interface which allows you to access the database of issued patents. The European Patent Office, that's what EPO stands for, is good. MCAM DOORS is a for-fee service that we at PubPat use, and it's an excellent technology. Although the USPTO and EPO do good, it goes above and beyond and does some more analytical analysis. And Lexis and Westlaw have some searching capabilities that the free sites do not. So what do you do once you have accessed a database? What are the different ways to find prior art? And these, you know, this isn't brain surgery here. This is pretty straightforward. The first is just Boolean searching, you know, certain terms within the specification, certain terms within a claim, you know, limited to certain issue dates or certain application dates. That's pretty straightforward. Classification of patents. If we go back to the model patent, the Dranch patent, and you look on the face of it, you go right below where the related U.S. application data is, you'll see international classification and U.S. classification. What they try to do, patent bodies, is they try to kind of like card catalog all technology, and they try to give a number to every kind of technology. And so you'll see here that in the U.S., class 426 slash subclass 549 is the classification that they gave to this technology, and you'll see that was the primary one. The other ones were all within class 426 and then different subclasses. You can search for all the patents that exist either in that class or in that subclass, and you can go to the Patent Office's manual of classification and see what that class defines. This isn't highly reliable. The Patent Office here in the United States changed its system of classification a little while ago to try to make room for expanding technologies, and so some things didn't get switched over, so you may not get all the oldest prior art. But it's still somewhat useful. You'll find some things that wouldn't pop up through Boolean because you would never expect someone would use a certain term to describe a similar thing. You know, it's not toast. You could do a Boolean search for toast. You wouldn't find a patent directed towards thermally effectuated wheat substrate product. But if you did the classification search, you'd come up with that. Relational. This is kind of like case law research, where you do when you do the shepherdizing of a case, you look for all the cases that refer to this case, or you look for all cases that this case refers to. That's the same thing you do with patents. You can look at all the patents that this patent refers to as prior art, and those are the references cited on the cover. And at the Patent Office's website and through the other databases as well, you can find all after arising patents that came that cite this patent as prior art, and then you can see what other patents those patents cite as prior art, and they'd kind of be like brothers or sisters or cousins to this patent. And you just go about finding patents by their citing of one another, kind of like a case. Now, just a word of caution. If you practice technology, which means to make, use, or sell any technology, once you are aware of a patent, you have a good faith duty to avoid infringing the patent. So be careful when you are aware of a certain patent and you want to search for prior art for it. If you go to the patent databases and find 5, 10, 50 other patents that relate to that technology, many of those may still be in force. And so now your duty to avoid infringement, which oftentimes means you have to hire an attorney to write you an opinion that you don't infringe it. You're having gone out and looked at all these additional patents actually increases the amount of liability you're on the hook for. Now, if you don't think this makes sense, if you think this is perverse, I agree with you. We agree with you. But the law is what the law is. We think patent law should encourage people to read patents, to learn from them. They disclose technology. People shouldn't be reinventing the wheel, but under the law as we have it, the law that's written by Congress and interpreted by the courts, if you read a patent and learn from it, you have enhanced liability for what is known as willfulness damages because you were on notice of the patent. And if you don't fulfill your duty to avoid infringing it, which means going out and hiring a lawyer, then when and if you are sued for infringing any of those patents, you could be ordered to pay triple the amount of regular damages and the plaintiff's attorney's fees, all of which would be avoided if you could prove that you didn't have any knowledge of the patent. So the long and short of it is to be careful when doing prior art research, or at least be mindful that you run a risk of putting yourself at exposure of increased damages the more patents that are currently in force that you make yourself aware of. And finding publications, I find, relies more on having human resources who can help you out. So that's a brief overview into finding prior art. The first step is identifying exactly what it is you're looking for and not realizing how narrow you need to be, which some people do by not focusing on the claims. Then there's the types of prior art, and different references and different things can be different kinds of prior art. And then the various ways to start out searching for prior art. Thank you for your time. I hope you found this presentation informative. Please note, however, that it does not constitute legal advice nor create an attorney-client relationship between you and the Public Patent Foundation. If you are involved with a specific matter or case, you are strongly encouraged to seek competent legal counsel licensed to practice in your jurisdiction.